You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, March 8th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, author, writer from Salon.com, Glenn Greenwald, on Attorney General Holder's speech on Monday, outlining what the Obama administration thinks is legal in terms of assassinating American citizens. Rather disturbing. In fact, significantly more disturbing than what the corporate media is probably covering today. That is, that President Obama hugged a professor at Harvard Law School. If you thought that Alinsky and Kenya was a story, wait till you hear from the huggers. Also on the program today, you would be surprised to find out who is benefiting materially from the war on drugs. Also, Anonymous, more on that snitch, and apparently Anonymous still exists. That's not a terrible surprise. A right-winger in Texas started an interesting pack fighting against the anti-incumbents. But, ladies and gentlemen, all these things that you should be worried about, the fact that President Obama hugged a law professor at Harvard, one of his law professors at Harvard, he hugged him. It's true. There's video. You can see it. And the what I would argue is slightly more disturbing assertion of executive power to assassinate American citizens. Apparently, the thing that you should be really, really afraid of is brought to you today by Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann. And that is, of course, that we are on the precipice of the government preventing us from having multiple children. Now, for those of us who have one, it might be possible to see the value of such a policy. But nevertheless, despite the fact that I do have one child and have a particular insight into the value of a one-child policy, there remains some, I think, question as to whether or not the government is going to institute such policy, but apparently not in Michelle Bachmann's mind. Here she is.
But the way that the liberals work is they appeal to one group of people after another. Conservatives tend to appeal to individuals, but the liberals tend to appeal to groups. This is an appeal to a group, women, that liberals have been losing.
Can you pause it for one Obamacare second, please? For those of you who are who don't speak Michelle Bachmann, and I should say that apparently she was on one of the Blaze's show, Glenn Beck's show. I'm not sure what, Real Politics or something. Just so you know, just so you get a clear sense of the playing field here, the group that Democrats are catering towards are women. And apparently, I don't have the statistics in front of me, but apparently this is a rather large group in America. Of course, they have these special interests, like women agitating for rights and to be treated like the rest of society. You know, not the group, but individual men. This group, women, they're agitating now. You know, I think we gave them the vote, but they still want more. So kudos to Congresswoman Bachman for making it clear that this group, or women, as some people refer to them, is just, they won't stop. They won't stop until they get it all.
Debate. This has been more of a winning issue for those who are liberals. So I think it's very important for us to frame this issue correctly. And the issue is that for women, they have more to lose under the government takeover of health care, which is Obamacare,
now, hold on
than
for a
gain.
Second.
Because women.
Now, hold on for a second. Now I'm confused, because now she's saying that the Republicans should address this group, the special interest women. Interesting. And I also wanted to mention she's about to tell a whole bucket of lies about the Affordable Care Act. For all of its flaws, actually, it's going to help this group, women. In fact, a lot of groups like Americans, insofar as it's going to limit the capacity for insurance companies to deny you coverage if you have a pre-existing condition, and for anywhere from 10 to 20 million Americans, maybe more, they will actually get health insurance. But continue.
Are the greatest purchasers of health care. And what women have seen is tremendous spikes in the cost of health care insurance, so much so that many of them are losing it because it's out of reach. And so they're seeing denial of care in the future. Women have a lot to lose under Obamacare. And I'll give you one example. If you want to go into specifics, what the government gives, the government can take away. It certainly isn't beyond the pale to think, in light of Kathleen Sebelius, the Health and Human Services Secretary, she said that it's important that we have contraceptives because that prevents pregnancy. And pregnancy is more expensive to the federal government. Going with that logic, according to our own Health and Human Services Secretary, it isn't far-fetched to think that the President of the United States could say, we need to save health care expenses. The federal government will only pay for one baby to be born in the hospital per family, or two babies to be born per family. That could happen.
Hold on. What's fascinating about this, aside from the fact that Michelle Bachman is trying to argue that this gives the authority for the president to institute a one-baby mandate, is that on one hand, she's saying that the government should not have the right to mandate that insurance companies provide prescription birth control to women. But then she's saying that the government could take away the mandate that there is birth conception, or that they could take away the ability for insurance to pay for health insurance coverage. So in other words, she's saying that if you give the power to the government to mandate what health insurers can cover, that they will then mandate that health insurance not be forced to cover this, which would bring her back to where we are now. And apparently, you can have more than one baby. And that, believe me, that's a minefield. You don't want to go there. All right, folks, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Glenn Greenwald of Salon.com in an interview I did with him just moments ago. Welcome back to the Majority Report. I am Sam Cedar. It is a pleasure to welcome back to this program Glenn Greenwald, writer, author of multiple best-selling books, and writer at Salon.com. Welcome back to the program, Glenn.
Great to be back, Sam.
Attorney General Holder gave a speech, I guess it was on Monday, at Northwestern University to explain the United States policy in regards to the targeted assassination of an American citizen abroad. Just give us the backstory of who was targeted and at least why, as far as what we were told at that point.
The first indication that we had of the existence of this program, of this power that the Obama administration has basically seized, was in January of 2010 when the Washington Post, Dana Priest, wrote an article, and buried in sort of the last three or four paragraphs was a revelation that there was a list of at least three Americans whom the CIA and the JSOC, a part of the military, had targeted for assassination, and that one of the people on the list, she said, was Anwar al-Awlaki, the cleric who was living in Yemen and is an American citizen, having been born in the United States in New Mexico. And a couple of months later, both the New York Times and the Post separately confirmed that al-Awlaki was in fact somebody that the CIA was actively trying to kill, not on a battlefield, not trying to detain him, simply trying to kill him. And so we've known for some time that the president believes that he has the power to target American citizens for execution. Anwar al-Awlaki has never been charged with a crime by the United States, was never indicted, never given due process of any kind, never accused of any crime. And then in a couple of times over the last year and a half, they actually have tried unsuccessfully to kill him with drones, once in December of 2010, and then again in mid-2011, they didn't kill him. They killed a lot of other people in both of those strikes. And then finally, a few months ago, they actually located al-Awlaki in Yemen, sent a drone to shoot a missile, which killed him along with another American, Samir Khan. And then 2 weeks later, al-Awlaki's 16-year-old son, who is also an American citizen, born in the United States, was killed by a separate drone strike in Yemen as well, although the government says that they didn't target him. It was just a coincidence that he was killed 2 weeks after his father was killed. They were targeting someone else who they ended up not getting because he wasn't at the location. And so the question has been, how is it that you as president believe that you have the authority to target American citizens for execution, given that the Constitution says the government shall not deprive anybody of life without due process of law? It was revealed.
I want to stop here because there was one element of this saga that I think is also relevant, is that at one point between the time that that story came out by Dana Priest and the killing of al-Awlaki, his father went to court in the United States to essentially say, like, you can't do this. You need to have some sort of public reason to kill him.
Right. I'm glad you mentioned that. I mean, you're absolutely right. That is crucial. The ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights represented al-Awlaki's father. They couldn't represent al-Awlaki because he was afraid to surface, given that the United States had made clear that they were going to kill him if he did. So his father went into a federal court and asked a federal judge, it's pretty extraordinary, for an injunction enjoining the president, President Obama, from killing his son without due process, without charging him first with a crime and presenting evidence of his guilt. And the judge, unfortunately, that got assigned was a Bush 43 appointee, far-right judge, who's known for deferring to broad theories of executive power, which is why George Bush appointed him to the federal bench. And that judge said, first of all, al-Awlaki's father has no standing to sue. It's only al-Awlaki who can sue. But then he also accepted the Obama DOJ's argument that federal judges have no business interfering in the decisions of the president about who is a terrorist, who is an enemy combatant, and who should be killed. That, to quote John Yoo, is a decision for the president alone to make. That was the argument made by the Obama Justice Department and accepted by this Bush 43 judge, who dismissed the lawsuit. He did actually say that this raises very serious and difficult questions about whether Milwaukee's constitutional rights are being violated, but he said this is for a president to decide in wartime, not for a court. And so they refused to enjoin the president from killing Milwaukee, and he went and killed Milwaukee. And what's, you know, what led to Holder's speech yesterday is that the Office of Legal Counsel, which during the Bush years is the office that produced all the memoranda saying you're allowed to torture George Bush, you're allowed to detain people with no charges, produced a memorandum at the request of the White House saying you're allowed to kill American citizens without charges. It was a big scandal during the Bush years when the OLC refused to release their legal memorandum because it's not a factual document. It's basically the law as the executive branch sees it. The Obama administration has refused to release its legal memorandum setting forth its reasons why they believe they can kill American citizens. They refused to answer inquiries. The ACLU is now suing to force them to explain themselves. And so that's what led to Holder's speech this week at Northwestern, was to say, okay, well, you want us to explain to you our views about why we're allowed to do this. Here are our views about why we can.
And we should also say, and you mentioned it briefly, but people need to understand that at no time was Milwaukee ever indicted. There was never any formal process of tendering any charges about him. And so, this just setting up the Holder's speech here, because frankly, it's pretty stunning. The big thing that jumps out of Holder's speech is, and I think that I'm quoting here directly, he says, due process as called for in the Constitution and judicial process are not one and the same, particularly when it comes to national security. The Constitution guarantees due process, not judicial process. Is there any case law that is explicit about that?
There's only one case that he could possibly have been referring to, which is a case that arose out of the Bush administration's detention of an American citizen, Yasser Hamdi, who had dual citizenship with a dual Saudi and American citizen. And the Bush administration in 2002 detained him and put him into a brig, a military brig, and refused to charge him with any crime, refused to present evidence of the accusations against him, and took the position that even with regard to American citizens, they had the right, the president did, to simply declare somebody a terrorist or an enemy combatant and to imprison them for as long as they wanted without any presentation of evidence, without any procedure to test that evidence and allow the person an opportunity to respond to it, to see it, to have a lawyer to deny the guilt. And in 2004, the Supreme Court issued an opinion in Hamdi versus Rumsfeld, in which the Supreme Court rejected the Bush administration's argument that they have the right to simply imprison American citizens without any process, not to kill them, just to detain them. And what the court said was, as an American citizen, even in the war on terror, even when the nation is at war, even when you're claiming they are a terrorist, you still have due process rights. And therefore, you have to provide Hamdi some opportunity to go before a neutral decision maker and present the evidence to him of his guilt, give him an opportunity to have a lawyer and to respond, and have a neutral arbiter decide whether or not these accusations are valid. The court said, we're not necessarily saying it has to be a full-blown trial. Maybe because we're in the war on terror, 9/11 just happened, there could be something less than that. But you do have to provide some legitimate procedure to give the person an opportunity to learn the charges, see the evidence, respond to them, and have a neutral arbiter outside of the executive branch make these decisions. And what the Bush administration did, instead of comporting with that, was they simply said, well, we don't want to show our evidence proving his guilt. So they released Hamdi to Saudi Arabia, and that was the decision of the Supreme Court that Holder is referring to. So even if you want to read that decision as broadly as Holder is reading it, which is to say, for an American citizen in the war on terror, if you want to detain them, not kill them, just detain them, you don't have to necessarily have a full-blown trial. The court didn't say that. They said maybe something less than a full-blown trial. They still said you need all these other requirements, none of which the Obama administration has even come close to fulfilling, not to detain somebody, but to kill them, which certainly should require at least as much, if not more.
All right, let me just read that quote from that Hamdi ruling. We therefore hold that a citizen detainee seeking to challenge his classification as an enemy combatant must receive notice of the factual basis for his classification and a fair opportunity to rebut the government's factual assertion before a neutral decision maker. And so from what we know, and people should remember that Hamdi is the case that John Roberts sat on as he was interviewing for a job with the Bush administration. So make no mistake about where this ruling sat on the spectrum of jurisprudence. And so when we talk about this, Holder, do we have a sense of what? Okay, so let me accept Holder's explanation that you don't need a judicial review. You just need some form of process that meets, I mean, one would think the Hamdi standard, because it's the only standard that we have out there that is less than going in front of a judge. So has he offered any evidence that something like that took place, that that there was a fair opportunity to rebut the government's factual assertions before a neutral decision maker?
Well, this was the real deceit in the Holder speech. He implied somehow that the Supreme Court has previously sanctioned what they were doing as comporting with the Due Process Clause. And yet, as that section that you just read proves, and remember, all Hamdi was saying, the decision was saying, was at the very least, this is what's required. It might be that a lot more is required, but at the very least, this is what's required, and you haven't done that, and therefore you can't hold Hamdi under these circumstances. So think about what the Obama...
And that was a standard just to hold, not to assassinate, which one precisely would think would be a higher bar.
Well, given that simply detaining them at some point will end, that it's reversible if you make an error, unlike killing them, of course that's the case. And, you know, think about what has happened in this case. The Obama administration never even announced that they were trying to kill Al-Awlaki. That simply was leaked to Dana Priest. There are other individuals on that list whose identities have never been revealed, who the administration is trying to kill, other citizens. So there's not even any notice of the accusations or the intent to kill. The administration has never presented any of its evidence, even in Holder's speech, to demonstrate that its accusation that Al-Awlaki was involved in operational plots against the United States, no evidence presented that any of that is true. There's obviously been no opportunity of any kind for Al-Awlaki to rebut the accusations, to present his own evidence that it's wrong, to cross-examine witnesses, to do any of the things that as Americans we instinctively understand are bare minimums for a fair process. All this is the president and his advisors getting together in secret with no oversight, no legal framework, and simply deciding that they want to kill somebody and then going out and killing them. And for Holder to suggest that that even comes close to complying with the due process requirement is offensive in the extreme.
And so we have a whole other series of assertions by Holder that, you know, we should walk through them, but in terms of under what instances they feel that they have the legal authority to issue an assassination, order. But we, in this case, have no means in which to know whether or not the very low bars that they have set for themselves, and I'm talking about whether or not you have an ability to capture this person, whether or not they are operative in terms of their association with terrorist organizations, we have no way to know whether or not those bars were actually met. And we certainly, there's no reason to believe there was, as called for in Hamdi, a neutral decision maker. The whole thing is simply a smokescreen, isn't it?
Well, the two most significant and most disturbing words in Holder's speech was the phrase, at least. What he said was that they have decided that under certain circumstances, it is permissible for them to kill an American citizen if there's evidence that they're engaged in imminent attacks on the United States, that apprehension is infeasible. And then what he said was, in these circumstances, at least we have the authority to kill an American citizen, meaning we're not saying this is the only circumstance in which we can do it, where these conditions are met. We're saying there are many circumstances, and this is one of them. At least in these circumstances, we can do that. Meaning there are others. We're not telling you what they are. We're not showing you any documents governing when it is that we can do them. We're just saying when these circumstances prevail, we can kill you. There may be other ones as well. And that's what happens when you allow executive branch officials with no oversight, no checks of any kind, and no legal framework to get together in total secrecy and decide how they're going to exercise power. And in this case, it's not just that they're deciding to exercise power. They're deciding to exercise the most extreme power that a government can possibly assert, literally, which is the power to kill their own citizens without any due process, without any trial, without any checks. And I simply don't understand how a Democratic Party and a progressive faction that was so vehemently outraged when George Bush simply asserted the power to eavesdrop on Americans without judicial oversight or to detain them without judicial oversight cannot be at least as outraged and really more so by the president's assertion that he can kill citizens with no judicial oversight.
Yeah, it is absolutely stunning how little attention this seems to have gotten. And let me also, before we just, I want to touch on that a little bit more, but one thing that really intrigues me about this decision is I spoke to Charlie Savage about his essay booklet, Power Wars.
Right.
And the thesis of that was that when you compare and contrast George Bush and Barack Obama, the issue isn't whether or not one is more or less a civil libertarian, because it really does appear that Barack Obama is at least as less of a civil libertarian as George Bush was. But that the distinction between the two administrations was that the Bush administration seemed to basically assume a certain authority and then as the president and then go out and do whatever they want. But that the Obama administration seemed to want to codify these things into law, which in at least my estimation is almost even more problematic. But how does this what we now know about this whole assassination process fit into that dichotomy that Charlie Savage drew?
Well, let me say two things. I don't think that President Obama is less of a civil libertarian than George Bush. What I think is that he's able to get away with things that George Bush would not have been able to get away with, such as this. Ezra Klein wrote a good column in the Washington Post yesterday, or a post on his Washington Post blog, pointing out the obvious, which is that had John Ashcroft asserted what Eric Holder asserted this week, that the Democratic Party would have been so up in arms that it would have been a major scandal. Mm-hmm. And that was what would happen when George Bush and John Ashcroft and Dick Cheney and David Addington would assert these unbelievably radical powers that assaulted everything we thought the country was about. There would be at least 50% of the country screaming and yelling and complaining so that it would at least cause a political controversy. And that limited what they can do. Because it's now a Democratic president doing this instead of George Bush and John Ashcroft, you have the Republicans who are very consistent. They're very supportive of President Obama. In fact, the only places you can find support for what Holder said are in places like National Review or with people like Representative Peter King. So you have all the Republicans who are perfectly fine with it, but now you have a huge number of Democrats who are either fine with it or are reluctant or unwilling to criticize the Democratic Party when it does these things. And so you don't have the political pushback that you would have had under the Bush administration. And that's what enables President Obama to go further in these civil liberties assaults than what George Bush. Remember, George Bush never asserted the power to target American citizens for death without due process and never actually made an order to do it either. But in terms of the comparison that you asked about, you know, I think, you know, one of the things that we've seen is that it was really in the end of George Bush's term, the second half of his term, when he did start asking Congress to codify the things that he had been doing previously without any authorization. So Congress codified his warrantless eavesdropping program when it passed the Five Amendments Act. They codified basically the Guantanamo regime when they passed the Military Commissions Act. And you really haven't seen much of that under the Obama administration. What you've seen instead, and this is a point that Charlie Savage often makes, is that where the real action is among debates between executive branch lawyers over what the president can do. And these debates take place in secret. They are conducted by people who answer to the president, who serve at his whim, who can be fired at any moment. They're basically the president's political appointees, and that's where the basically government policy and the law are being made in total secrecy, in debates between administration lawyers that ultimately end up getting codified in legal memorandum. Yeah, basically, we live under because they're the president's political appointees. Almost always, they end up concluding that the president can do whatever he wants, and that's what we've seen in this case as well.
All right. Well, so Glenn, I mean, you know, I've noticed that there are different people who are sort of online or sort of reevaluating their estimation that this constitutional law professor is going to be protective of civil liberties. I mean, what is the next step? I mean, is it simply sort of the ACLU attempting to get hold of these memoranda? Is it to spread? I mean, for those of us who care about the idea that this, you know, we could very well have a President Santorum or Romney or, frankly, Obama, you know, in the next term, and don't want the president to have the ability to unilaterally assassinate citizens, what do we do now?
Well, this to me is, you know, the most important issue that is raised by the question you've just asked. Sometimes when we talk about civil liberties and Obama on civil liberties, there's a tendency to sort of conceive it as this kind of side, tangential, almost boutique concern that, yeah, it'd be good if he were better on civil liberties, but, you know, in terms of the things that really matter, you know, he's so much better than the Republicans that we're willing to overlook these things. Leaving aside that isn't at all how Democrats and progressives talked about these issues under the Bush administration, I mean, these issues were at the center of the Democratic Party's grievance against the Bush administration. And you look at Obama's campaign and you'll see that. It really isn't a side issue. It is about the kind of country we are and the way in which our government functions and the power that it can exercise. So it isn't just about can the government take action against accused terrorists. It's can the government decide to imprison and kill citizens in secret and without having to prove in a court or anywhere else that the accusations are justified, which then determines what the relationship is between the president and the Congress, what the relationship is between the president and the citizenry. We've seen the president wage a war in Libya even after Congress voted against its authorization. So we see this incredibly powerful executive branch, so much more powerful than the other two branches, continuing to gain huge amounts of power in a way that's virtually unbridled, not in segmented areas, but in the areas that determine what kind of country we are. Are we a free country? Are we tyrannical? Or something in between. And so, you know, the ACLU can continue to sue and will, and they've done stalwart work, as have other civil liberties groups. But ultimately, and, you know, this goes back to what the founders said at the time they wrote the Constitution, the only thing that will determine whether or not the rights guaranteed by that document are meaningful or just, you know, sort of words, is whether citizens insist upon their preservation. And so if the Democratic Party and its followers are willing to watch these rights be continuously whittled away simply because it's their party's leader who is doing it, what they're essentially doing is converting what was, until a few years ago, very controversial and radical policies into bipartisan consensus, into the orthodoxy of the American political class, and ensuring that these policies are no longer debatable. They are entrenched within the political framework, no matter which party is in control. And so the only way to reverse that is by citizens banding together, whichever faction they're in ideologically or politically, and saying that we don't trust any politician to make decisions about which citizens should be executed without due process, or which citizens should be imprisoned, or which war should be conducted, that we are still a democracy, still a constitutional republic, and we want to bind down our leaders with those constraints. And if citizens aren't willing to do that in the name of partisan gain or opportunistic political advantage or whatever, then those rights will be gone. They may be still offered on a piece of parchment, but they will be meaningless. And so it's up to the citizenry and to those people who are politically engaged to decide where their priorities lie.
Glenn Greenwald from Salon.com, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sam. Appreciate it.
All right, folks. And now we will head into the better half of the program. You can support this show. In fact, you need to support this show. Because we have no other means of support other than your membership. You can become a member right now at majority.fm. It's hard times for a lot of folks out there. Every day, it seems like we hear from someone who can no longer support the show. And as is always the case, if you cannot afford to become a member, you want to hear the extra 50-some-odd minutes of the show, or if you just want to express that you would become a member and support the free show every day, but, you know, a lot of people have lost jobs. Remember, their husband or their wife has lost their job. They go through medical problems. If you cannot afford the show but want access, email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. And we will work something out with you. No one will be denied because of finances. But for those of you who can't afford to support the program, it's obviously we need you to continue on. And what?
You know, if you listen to the show daily and it's not, and you're not a member and it's not for financial reason, I would like to know why, actually. I'm interested. Why don't you email us and let us know why?
Yes, actually, that would be helpful. I don't think
I
Matt is being aggro here.
I'm just being serious.
Out of curiosity. Yes, what could we do? If you listen to the show 2-3 times a week, 5 times a week, and are not a member, email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com and tell us what could we do to get you to become a member. I don't know why it never occurred to me to ask that question.
Yeah. If it's not a financial reason.
It's only been
reason.
A year.
If it's not a financial reason, why aren't you a member?
I mean, I guess if it's just laziness, then they're not going to take the time to email. It's like.
But then if we receive.
I remember I had a teacher once who said, could the people who are shy in this class and don't like to raise their hand and talk, please raise your hand and tell me why?
But that's also an answer, though, because if we receive no emails, then we know that it's because everyone's just lazy.
All right. Fair enough. You want to be a part of the program, 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. We'll get to that anonymous story and more coming right up.